Talofa Lava, this is Tangata Otemoana from RNZ Pacific. I'm Don Wiseman. And today, dengue in Samoa, a new approach to elections mooted in Solomon Islands, Papua New Guinea's to look to Africa on how to contain illegal guns, and containing emissions from plastics. These stories and more today on Tangata. As dengue cases in Samoa continue to rise, the Ministry of Health there is urging locals and tourists to be vigilant and take precautions. An outbreak was declared last Friday, with more than 80 cases reported in the first 2 weeks of April. Tiana Haxton has more.
Dengue fever is a viral infection spread from mosquitoes to humans. Symptoms include high fevers, fatigue, muscle and joint pain, and rashes. With cases on the rise, Samoa's Ministry of Health is urging households to look out for their high-risk family members. As the country tackles the outbreak, Dr. Glenn Fatupaito says they are keeping a close eye on those that may face complications.
We're mindful of our very old, our very young, our pregnant women as well. We don't want any complications. Yeah, and if you're sick, come see a doctor if things are getting worse.
The ministry is working on clean-up campaigns and fumigating schools, hospitals and other potential breeding grounds for dengue-carrying mosquitoes. While the Ministry of Foreign Affairs is not issuing a specific travel advisory for Samoa, it does advise travellers to have medical and travel insurance policies that include a provision for medical evacuation by air. It is also advising New Zealanders in Samoa to register their details with the ministry. Professor in Infectious Diseases Dr. Mark Thomas says the last outbreak in Samoa 6 years ago resulted in 5 fatalities. He is urging travellers to follow all health recommendations and invest in good repellents.
And there's various different repellents available, but ones that have a reasonably high concentration of a substance that's abbreviated DEET, D-E-E-T, and to be among the best insect repellents.
Dr. Thomas says the risk of complications is more common amongst those that have had dengue fever before, and most travellers will thus not have to worry too much.
And the second or the third episode of dengue fever can be much more severe than the first one. Second or third episodes of dengue fever tend not to occur in people who've travelled from New Zealand as tourists.
He says severe cases are rare in tourists who catch dengue fever. Samoa's Ministry of Health will begin publishing weekly updates and recommendations from Friday onwards.
As counting is wrapping up in the Solomon Islands, the Electoral Commission is looking at trialling out-of-constituency voting. Only a handful of seats in the 50-member parliament yet to be officially declared. There's no outright winner, but lobbying to form the country's next government's underway. As of Wednesday, two large blocs in the winner's circle, Independents and the incumbent Prime Minister Manasi Songavare's Our Party, were tied with 12 MPs each. Corroy Hawkins spoke with the Chief Electoral Officer, Jasper Anisi, and asked him how he thought the country's first joint national election went.
So I think we are 90% away from closing all the results. All the results have come in except for Guadalcanal, only two constituency and provincial wards within those two constituencies are still yet to be counted. But hopefully by end of this evening, all results should come out.
And any more challenges, anything? What have been some of the biggest challenges so far, logistics or human error, some of the things that we've been hearing? Just go through some of those, please.
Yeah, there's a few challenges that we met. There's some mistakes, some errors by our officials, but there are laws and policies that we can use to remedy those kind of things, but there's nothing that can deter an election or something like that.
And the process from here on, once those last polling stations, the counting's through, what happens after that?
So we do verification in terms of checking the numbers, checking the voter turnouts and all these things. And once that is done, then we gazette. We send a notice back to the Attorney General for vetting and gazetting, and then we gazette it. Once it's gazetted, then we send it back to the Governor General and to the Clerk of Parliament. And then the next part starts the formation of government. And that from that end, our job as election management body, we stop once the gazettes are out.
And the 30-day petition period starts once the gazette is out as well?
That is correct.
For candidates who have lost and are preparing things, do they have ongoing engagement with the commission in terms of preparing those petitions? Or how does that work for us, a losing candidate preparing a petition? Is it a separate legal process?
I think all the candidates will have to bring the evidence, because it's either you challenge the process or you challenge the other candidate for bribery. So most petition will be against our process, and we have our, if we know those claims coming in, then we will prepare our evidence to support or our defense in that sense.
We've had so many observer missions here in the country. Have you got any feedback from them so far from different observer missions?
Yes, we have two feedback, one from G7 Plus and Pacific Island Forum. From both reports, verbally discussed with us, the commission, I think they're very impressed about what's being done in these elections, and I think everything is on track. There are a few recommendations that we can build on from there, one such as out-of-constituency voting. But we shelved that for a while, because knowing joint election is a huge task in itself. But now that we've done joint elections, now we will be looking forward in trying to implement out-of-constituency voting to help our, especially our seasonal workers who've been out of the country working, so that we can provide them that avenue, and also students who are studying during election period, so that they can cast their vote. So that's the next step the commission will be looking after everything. And one more policy that we want to do is to have the continuous registration of electors as we go along.
Papua New Guinea has been called on to look at how African nations curbed gun violence. PNG's been racked with violent gun crime for many years. With signs in recent times this is worsening. A conference last week involving the United Nations, the European Union and PNG police and military in Port Moresby discussed ways to overcome the problem. Our PNG correspondent Scott Whitey told me what came out of the conference.
They've decided on setting up something of a council that will be the overarching body looking at gun violence, gun control, and drawing from best practices all over the world. So best practices out of Africa, where they've got similar issues like Papua New Guinea, where with the use of small arms and light weapons. That is just in draft form yet. It hasn't evolved to a document yet, and that'll be taken to NEC for approval. There's a six-month deadline that they've put to create a working document or some sort of a document that can be viewed by NEC. So that's basically where it's at right now after 3 days of that workshop.
When we talk about best practice, what is best practice? You know, we had weapons disposal bins placed around Bougainville, and there's a big question mark over whether or not that worked. So what do we mean by best practice?
Yeah, so it's a council that looks specifically at guns violence, the importation of guns. The other important thing that has come about from this one is the removal of the role of guns register, a firearms register, from the commissioner and put under this committee, if it comes to that. So it's still in its infancy, it hasn't, but that's one of the suggestions. Now, that suggestion has been drawn from the guns control report, the Singerok report that was written in 2005, 19 years ago, which hasn't really been acted upon. So Major General Singerok, who was there also contributing at the workshop, stated that all of his suggestions have to be reviewed also. And the workshop agreed with that review of the gun control report and to incorporate it in some way or form in another document that will be taken to NEC.
for something like this to work, it's going to need some significant teeth, isn't it? At some point, authorities are going to have to approach people with guns and say, hand them over, aren't they?
Yes. There was a lot of criticism about political will. Now, if you look at the political will over the last 19 years since the gun control report, it hasn't really been there. I mean, there was an initial fire at the beginning with Sir Michael Somare under his government and Birakimi Sopa as police minister asking for this report to be produced. Now, that report was produced. It hasn't been acted upon. And successive governments haven't done anything about it. Now, this particular government, the Marape-Rosso government, has initiated several things. Now, one of those things is about changes in legislation and specifying the harshest penalties for illegal weapons, possession of illegal weapons, and that's life imprisonment for anyone found in possession of illegal weapons. But the problem is the enforcement. So the Deputy Prime Minister was also at the closing, and he's stated to the workshop, and senior commanders of the RPNGC and the Defence Force were there as well. So he said, while the government has acted on all of this and changed laws as legislators are supposed to do, the enforcement is still weak. And there has to be this willingness to go out and actually arrest people who are in possession of weapons. Now, it's not difficult to identify them. It's all over social media. It's just there's been no will to go out and arrest them. There's also, I did a separate interview with the Deputy Prime Minister. He talked about the PNG's intelligence capacity that was neglected over some 20 years. So government's putting money into the intelligence sector. And the Deputy Prime Minister has been meeting with the Police Minister, and the Defence Minister has been meeting with Defence Police and the National Intelligence Organization to improve their capacities so that they're able to better identify and pass on that information to people who can actually go out and arrest them.
...175 nations have agreed to develop a legally binding agreement on plastic pollution by the end of this year, prompting a major step towards reducing greenhouse gas emissions from plastic production, use and disposal, being held in Ottawa in Canada this week. The last major round of negotiations has brought together the Treaty's Intergovernmental Negotiations Committee to draft a global legally binding agreement by the end of 2024, according to the UN. Alicia Foon spoke with project scientist at the Benioff Ocean Science Laboratory, Neil Nathan, who's been on the sidelines of the negotiations in Ottawa.
The negotiations are still early on, but we have seen something that kind of happened with the Paris Climate Accords and the negotiations with that treaty, where rather than having core obligations, you know, universal policies and specifics that are being baked into this treaty, there is definitely a lot of movement for folks in different countries wanting to sort of go the route of national action plans or national implementation plans, essentially where a general, perhaps amorphous, perhaps slightly more concrete goal is set for where plastic pollution and waste management is in the future, but completely leaving it up to countries and individual countries to set their own measures, to set their own policies in place. And that, you know, a lot of the definition of sort of what those policies are to be left up to the countries. I would say there's clear reasons why that might be the case. One, people are obviously scared of agreeing to all the same thing in the specific language of the treaty, and it's much easier for everyone to essentially gravitate more towards national action plans. But there's also sort of, you know, equity challenges where you have certain developed countries that have typically and historically had significantly higher consumption rates, significantly higher generation of waste. And then you have developing countries which haven't been as responsible for this part of the problem and in fact have a disproportionate amount of the burden of the problem.
You mentioned that a lot of small island nations, and we'd like to know what the data shows and what larger countries are willing to do to step up. Because like you said, it's unequal, and the waste contribution is far less in a lot of Pacific Island mm-hmm. nations. Plastic is such a huge issue. When you think of the likes of Kiribati, Samoa, but there's actually a lot of plastic throughout the islands. And when people come to visit, they're shocked that there's no recycling systems and that there's plastic littered everywhere. And that's also going into the ocean. But then there are also almost plastic islands within the ocean too. That's mm-hmm. a huge problem, because that's drifted from larger nations too. And so What can be said for support around plastic and helping smaller nations that don't have the funding? How can we support our Pacific nations who are actually bearing the brunt of climate change as we speak?
That's such a critical question. And I'm personally very driven by a lot of this. And I'm a marine scientist by training. I used to study coral reefs. I've spent time in the South Pacific, spent time in Palau and in Indonesia, and have, while snorkeling and diving in some of the most beautiful reefs ever, plastic bag bumps into your face or wraps around your regulator. It really truly is everywhere. And to know that a lot of this plastic is not being generated within the Pacific, within these countries, and that it's coming from abroad, and also knowing that, you know, there's such limited infrastructure to deal with a problem that is being dumped on their doorstep. That's one of the driving forces behind trying to get, you know, essential core obligations in this, to this treaty. And so what I'd say, distribution of funding and the importance of utilizing this treaty to essentially distribute and channel finance from the global north to the global south, where it is needed most, particularly for waste management infrastructure. That's one of the key things that I know lots of countries are focusing on for the treaty. And there have been some pretty interesting proposals for how to do this and how to close this financing gap.
The treaty is expected to be finalized in late 2024 in Busan in Korea. The University of Auckland's launched an initiative to improve Maori and Pacifica University entrance pass rates and increase success at tertiary level. Partnering with 12 secondary schools, the university hopes the initiative will boost academic success. Maori and Pacific University entrance attainment dropped from 40% in 2020 to 34% in 2022. It compares with the national UE attainment of 53% in 2020 and 50% in 2022. Susanna Suisuki spoke to Associate Director, Schools and Community Engagement, Lilitina Vaka, about the initiative.
We've partnered with 12 Auckland schools and have agreed to achieve UE parity by the year 2030. So really what we're doing with our schools across Auckland is saying, how do we increase university entrance achievement rates for our Māori and Pacific students, and then tracking that across the next 6 years. We've seen across the schools about an 11 to just under 40% disparity when it comes to achievement rates. And I can talk a little bit more about what sits under UE success, but broadly that's what we're looking at achieving.
How long has this partnership been in the works for?
Depends how you look at it. But really what we've had is the introduction of our Taumata Teitei strategy. So our Vision 2030 strategy as a university. And then in 2019, so 5 years ago, we had Whakamana Tangata. That was our student services strategy. And through those, particularly through Whakamana Tangata, we saw a big restructure in my office. The Schools and Community Engagement Office was established 2 years ago. So it's been a five-year journey in terms of getting the university kind of strategically where it needs to be in terms of capability and a shared one, shared vision in terms of our strategic priorities. And over the last 2 years, what we've seen is a significant amount of resource invested from the university to make sure we've got the right operating model, the right talent, the right team to engage with schools. So operationally, we've been at this for 2 years and have just achieved the collective signing earlier last week.
Why is it important to boost the number of Māori and Pacific students at uni? Is it the only pathway that improves life chances for that particular population?
We think about our high school. At high school, university entrance is the highest qualification you can get at high school. It's not NCA level 3, which is what some of our learners and some of our families think. So there's an education piece there. And if we dig into UE success more specifically, UE success under this agreement isn't about achieving university entrance as it currently stands. So if you go onto the NZQA website and you write university entrance, what it will tell you is a minimum of requirements that you have to get university entrance. And the language choice in that is in part of the problem. So what we've done over many years is the issue of low education around UE versus level 3. But compounded with that, we've got students who have been taught, if I just get this, then I've got UE. And what we're seeing in our data as a university is that university entrance, if we think about it as a fit for purpose qualification, it's not the minimum. So the minimum talks about 3 approved subjects. So that's another education piece that lots of people don't know about. You need to do subjects that are university approved. But beyond that, you can get those credits under the current UE system with internal credits. And what we're seeing as a university is if you come in with external credits, for example, more than 20 external credits, you're 95% likely to experience success in your first year. And that part is really important. But beyond UE, we're starting to think about how do we support our students, not only to get UE, not only to come into the university, but if we rethink what UE means, how to thrive and succeed at the university.
You talk a lot about the lack of preparedness for university when it comes to our Māori and Pacific students. But within this initiative, is there room to also address why high school students are needing to work part-time or full-time jobs to support their families? That will be a barrier to gaining university entrance, wouldn't it?
Absolutely. And there's no silver bullet. And I should add, lack of preparedness is certainly not due to the learner. When we talk about lack of preparedness, we're really talking about inequities that play out in how we're supporting learners and their families to make informed decisions, which starts really early. So inequity is actually the foundation of that lack of preparedness that we talk about. But it is really complex. And we're aware in our partner schools where we've had conversations around that complexity and the demands of work. And just to speak around work, one of the things we found is we've been delivering Pacific Academy, which is a math and science tutoring program aimed at supporting students to succeed in external exam. And one of the things we found is students are coming through word of mouth, and one of the students said, oh, a mate of mine told me about this at work. So we know that you can do both of those things. You can work and you can thrive academically with the right support and with a real collective approach. That's not the onus on the learner. That's not the onus on the family. It's far broader than that in terms of the school environment, the teacher capability and development, and the education piece across the community.
Well, the price paid for cocoa is soaring due to drastically low yields in West Africa. It's highlighted the fragility of smallholder farmers in the Pacific, particularly in Papua New Guinea. Farmers are earning much more after years of being paid a pittance for their production, but that price lift is likely to be transitory. At the same time, most PNG cacao farmers are old and enticing the youth to return to the challenge. Cacao, or cocoa farming, is vitally important for PNG. As a research fellow at the University of Sydney, Tom Swan, who's been working in PNG to develop integrated cocoa farming systems, explains.
It's very important. It's around 2 million people. It's their main source of income. So they use this income directly to pay essential things like medical fees and school fees. So it is very much their bread and butter of their personal economies.
For one of those farmers, Agatha Igag, who farms near Madang, the impact of the price surge is huge. She says each year she produces between 30 and 35 bags of cacao, and their value is up nearly 400%.
2 years ago, one bag cost about 450 kina a bag. Now, 1,700 per bag.
Agatha Igag also runs a nursery supplying cacao trees to other farmers. The cacao ambassador, Una Brown, who has had a lot of dealings with Pacific farmers, trying to help them raise quality so they can sell to the usually more valuable boutique market, is warning that a price crash is just around the corner and they need to be ready.
We don't want to see that price crash in 18 months. We want this to stay consistent. And in order to do that, because we're talking about the world stock exchange market, right? So it goes up and down in everything, all shares, everything. So for the Pacific, specifically for the Pacific, what we want to do is, over the next 18 months, work with the farming communities to increase their quality. So even if the World Stock Exchange market goes down, we will still be able to get that price for the farmers.
Another critical factor is that the farmers are mostly old and getting older, while PNG has a substantial youth bulge in its population. Some of the work that people like Tom Swan have been doing is developing the Family Farm Team Program. It aims to foster collaboration in families by ensuring everyone in the family steps up and does their share. One key aspect of this is encouraging youth involvement, as Mr. Swan points out.
What I'm arguing is that there's very real financial opportunities and entrepreneurial opportunities for smallholder farmers. And if the youth were more inclined to get involved in the family smallholder farm, they're very likely to produce money that way.
Mr. Swan says one technique they're trying is the use of technology to attract the young back. He says typically younger people are more inclined to use their mobile phones.
So we're developing a mobile application which would have cocoa farming to help them look at things like how to compost, what sort of amendments they can make to the soil, when the best time to pick the cocoa pods are, pruning of trees and other such things to try to engage youth in that medium.
And for Una Brown, her hope is that more and more farmers in PNG will come to know what cocoa is and the reasons it's prized in the Western world. She's convinced this greater understanding would boost enthusiasm for growing cacao. A Pacific lecturer completing her master's degree in social work, diving into a thesis addressing the misinterpretation and misuse of biblical scripture to gain power and control in relation to family violence. New Zealand's ranked as the worst developed country in the OECD for family violence. Genevieve Sang-Yum is of Samoan and Chinese heritage and has run family violence programs for Maori and Pacifica female victims and perpetrators. She says she's concerned by the growing number of Pacifica men who migrate to New Zealand and have used Bible verses to justify committing acts of domestic violence against their partners. Alicia Foon spoke with Genevieve Sang-Yum about her work in helping men reframe how they view scripture instead of it being used as a weapon to justify violence within families.
A lot of the biblical texts and how they've been interpreted, They can be misinterpreted depending on their own idea or definition of the use of language. Hearing men address certain parts of the Bible, such as God created a woman from the rib of a man, we delve deep into having an open conversation about what that means to each of them. And the common response that come from the group was that because her role is to bear children and to help him to do what she, you know, she's meant to be doing. And so when you pull that text out and highlight the word partnership, it shifts their thinking in terms of understanding what that interpretation of that specific text actually means. And I link that text to the equality wheel, which is the wheel that was developed by the team at Duluth, Minnesota, and talk about what negotiation looks like in a relationship. My role as a program facilitator is to basically pull out the answers that they already know. They already know this stuff, but it's the influence that where it is that came from. Whoever the influencer is that's teaching them these ways of understanding what this part of the text means is the reason why they're basically trying to use these texts to justify their actions. But when we delve deep into the particular text, when it says God saw that Adam needed a partner, therefore created him a partner. So we highlight the text of partnership and what that looks like in a relationship. And it really does shift their way of thinking. There's no aim to remove their belief in the Bible, but help them to understand what that interpretation means, because the Bible is harmless, but it depends on what part of the text you pull apart that helps fit your way of justifying your behavior. That's the dangerous part. But they are testimonies and stories that of people's lives, and that's how people are interpreting specific texts. They'll pull a specific text to say, see, this is what it means. This is why I do what I do, because this is what it says in the Bible, rather than exploring the whole interpretation and what the meaning of that text is about. So it's really good to hear when men talk, bring out specific texts of the Bible. I don't pull them out. They bring it out themselves. And we have open discussions about it and ask what that means. And it's a very interesting space to be in. It's really good for me to learn from a male abuser's perspective. And these are our Pacific Island men who only know what they know.
Have you seen a change since having Talanoa with Pacific Island men about family harm and domestic violence? And is there a willingness to change and see a different point of view?
I believe for some, for men who generally, especially our Pacific men, in specific sessions, I have observed that there's a bit of a surprise in terms of not knowing that what they're doing is wrong. I facilitated a program for one of the male abusers who was referred to a nonviolence program in relation to his assault to his partner in a public place. And a member of the public reported the assault to the police, hence how he ended up in the program. And he shared, I hit my partner because she's my partner. And so a lot of the men in the room would agree. And we'd have open discussions that to hear what their reasons are, because it's my right. She's my partner. And what issues I have with her is nobody else's business. And this is a Samoan man who is also he's a Christian person, but he doesn't know any better. He doesn't know any more than what he's been taught. It wasn't until we explored types of behaviors and abusive behaviors and exploring what the language of love looks like. Is it hurtful? Is it abusive? The more we delve deep into these conversations, the more they started to learn. So a lot of our, especially our male Pacific people who have just migrated from overseas, have only just discovered and learned about types of behaviors that are unacceptable.
And that is Tangatoa Te Moana from RNZ Pacific. Thanks for joining us. I'm Don Wiseman. Until next time, Tofa.